Welcome to Improbable Walks, the podcast that brings you to the streets of Paris wherever you are. My name is Lisa Passold, and I'm a writer and traveler who loves to walk in the City of Light. Every episode, we step into history by strolling down a different block of the city, exploring buildings and people of the past and of the present. If you're a regular listener, thank you for your time and ears. If you've just discovered the podcast, please check out my website, lisapassold.com, for photos, previous streets, and more information. You can encourage this podcast by subscribing, which lets you know when our new monthly episode is posted and helps Improbable Walks to find new listeners. Today, we're making a tiny exception to our usual street wandering, because instead of a street, today we're going to explore one very specific address, number 55, Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré. Because this past autumn, I visited the French Presidential Palace, and the history of the building is well worth an improbable walk. The address, of course, is number 55, Faubourg Saint-Honoré. Every year, the palace holds an open house as part of the Journée Européenne du Patrimoine, the weekend where all kinds of fascinating heritage buildings are open to the public. Getting a ticket to the presidential open house is highly competitive, and my well-connected Paris journalist friend, Heather Stimler, has been trying to get us tickets for ages. Finally, this year, we were lucky and we got to tour the Élysée at number 55 in the heart of the Tony 8th arrondissement. Because I'm a history geek, I was especially excited to visit the palace because of one of its previous inhabitants, Madame de Pompadour. And I wanted to see the famous interiors of the palace, which are filled with historical antique furniture and contemporary art. The Palais de l'Élysée was originally built in 1722 for the Comte d'Evreux by the architect's son of the royal garden designer. The Comte d'Evreux was known to be wildly ambitious, unpleasant to his enemies at court, and extraordinarily rich, mostly because he married the daughter of the wealthiest man in Paris at the time, whose money came from the slave trade. Unbothered by this blood-stained money, the Comte d'Evreux built himself a vast mansion in an area of Paris that had been undesirable swampland. Originally, here at the far western edge of the city was not a gorgeous neighborhood. The banks of the River Seine flooded close by, and at the time, in the 1720s, the area was muddy, smelly, and poor. And yet, this road was the main route out to Versailles. If you wanted to visit the king from Paris, this was the road. No surprise, King Louis XIV hired the famous landscape artist André Le Nôtre to create gardens alongside the road, making the route more pleasant for travel, to more easily lure the court out to his glittering Versailles. This road only became known as the Champs-Élysées around this period of 1700. In Greek mythology, the Elysian fields were a place to stroll in the afterworld, a beautiful garden promenade for dead heroes. For this Parisian boulevard, the name was a slightly sarcastic wink to the contrast between the glamorous path out to Versailles and the insalubrious neighborhood. If you want to know more about the evolution of the Champs-Élysées, check out my podcast from June 2022, Season 3, Episode 5. Is today we're going to stay focused on the presidential palace, which is called the Palais de l'Élysée by the media, or sometimes just the Élysée, or number 55. Because you see, the presidential palace has its main address at number 55 on the expensive street, Faubourg Saint-Honoré, but the gardens of the palace spread over towards a tiny street that is essentially on the Champs-Élysées. Now, as you probably remember, Paris was originally swampy everywhere, and in this particular area, it was an advantage for the gardens because the water was ideal for creating ponds, fountains, etc., for the lush gardens that now surround the palace. For the open house, I was one of the lucky ticket holders to walk in from the Champs-Élysées through the gardens that lead to the palace. Fortunately, the weather was gorgeous, so we could admire the huge trees, many planted for specific international diplomatic visits to Paris. The oldest trees in the presidential garden date from just before the French Revolution. There was a military band playing outside the day we visited, and within the palace, as an extra bonus, the reception rooms were filled with restoration specialists who talked about the craft required to maintain this historic building. Because the Élysée Palace is not simply a pretty mansion where the politicians live. The Élysée is a huge, gorgeous display of French craft and artistic know-how. The painted and gilded walls, the glittering chandeliers, and the antique furnishings are all extraordinary, and they all belong to the state. Back in 1663, the style-conscious Sun King, Louis XIV, founded the Royal Garde Meuble, which has evolved into the National Heritage Collection of Furniture. The Royal Garde Meuble, i.e. the Royal Closet, grew through the revolutionary years and became even larger under Napoleon I. By the year 1870, the massive Second Empire Meuble Impérial became a disorganized series of Meuble National dispersed into different locations, two of which burned down. Bookkeeping was chaotic, and throughout the entire 20th century, different government factions tried to get the furniture collection into better shape. The notable organizer was Culture Minister André Malraux, who began in 1964 to create a restoration and creation wing for the Mobilier National. Today, this national furniture organization, the Mobilier National, looks after 100,000 pieces of furniture and textile, an entire history of French style and art. Every now and then, a minor scandal breaks out when the indexers realize that a bureaucrat has stolen a sculpture or antique clock, because there are simply so many objects it's difficult to keep track of them all. One of the responsibilities of the Mobilier National is to furnish the Élysée Palace, which is one of the main reasons I wanted to visit. Today, the Élysée has 365 rooms furnished with 5,000 pieces of furniture from the National Furniture Collection, as well as 100 clocks, many of them antique ticking clocks, which personally would drive me crazy after a while, but they're very beautiful to look at. This also includes outdoor garden furniture for the palatial grounds and some really wonderful contemporary garden sculptures. There's also an underground nuclear command center, no joke, and there's probably antique furniture in there too, though obviously we did not visit it. Whenever France elects a new president, the private apartments and offices are redecorated. The new president and their family choose the paintings, the furniture, and the carpets they want from the vast national furniture collection, which is why the presidential office looks different under different leaders, because the collection provides whatever they wish for desks, chairs, tables, the linen on those tables, and which dishes they want to use. The current layout of the palace is quite different from its original plan, but traces of each period of history remain. There's no official documentation about the ghosts in the Élysée. Certainly there have been enough complicated characters who have lived here over the past few centuries, there ought to be some interesting phantoms. The original owner, the Comte d'Evreux, died in 1753, and it was such a splendid mansion that King Louis XV promptly bought the place to give to his mistress, the Marquise de Pompadour. The clever, beautiful Jeanne-Antoinette Poisson was nicknamed Renette. She was not originally an aristocrat. She was born in 1721 in Paris. Her father's last name was Poisson, which means fish. So not only did she have a very middle-class father who worked in finance, but she also had an ugly last name. What's more, her biological father was probably someone else, possibly a tax collector who paid for Renette's expensive convent education and also arranged for her wedding. Renette married at the respectable age of 20 and created a classy salon of writers and philosophers in a mansion just outside Paris, but she had big plans. In 1745, she successfully seduced Louis XV at a costumed garden party where he was dressed as a tree and she was a sexy shepherdess. But Renette was no fool. King Louis XV was renowned for his good looks and for his endless procession of mistresses. Renette may have started out as the king's lover, but she had much more power once she became the king's best friend, advisor, and confidant. Their romantic relationship lasted perhaps 5 years, but by the time the king gave her this palace in 1753, their friendship had taken center stage. Her influence over the king continued for nearly 20 years, ending only with her death. The Pompadour was an intellectual force to be reckoned with, beautiful, sure, but also a critical thinker and very wily. While she lived in the palace, in the middle 1700s, the Élysée was filled to bursting with stylish bits of porcelain, dishes, dressing table accoutrements, and books, because Madame de Pompadour collected everything and was known for her exquisite taste. When she lived here, the décor would have been rococo, a word not used during her era, though it was her style. The word rococo comes from rocaille, decorative shell and stone effects of the era, and it was initially derogatory, used during the Revolution to look back upon the frivolous royal style. However, La Pompadour epitomizes the style of rococo, a much lighter Parisian feel than Baroque. It's more sinuous, inspired by nature, and yes, fair, looking at some of the paintings of the era, possibly rococo has too many dolphins and pink cupids. But unlike the constant gods and goddesses and weighty subject matter that pleased Louis XIV, the goal of rococo style was to bring love, beauty, and joy into our complicated lives. And honestly, today, I cannot fault them for that. Walking through the Élysée Palace now, there's a wonderful contrast between that desire for light and beauty and the obvious serious meetings and conversations which take place in the elegant offices and receptions. I suspect the Pompadour would understand this combination of elaborate formal decor and political negotiations. After all, she spent 20 years of her life influencing the King of France. Along with her enthusiasm for pretty things, she encouraged the publication of Diderot's encyclopedia, and she was an expert political manipulator. If her ghost wanders the presidential palace today, she's definitely not bored. Sadly, when the Pompadour died in 1764, her gorgeous Paris home was sold, and the fabulous collections, including her porcelains, were dispersed. In her will, the Pompadour had attempted to leave the palace to her brother, but the king overruled her testament. After a few years of turbulence, the palace was bought by a wealthy banker, who was famous for having four mistresses, all living in beautiful pavilions on the grounds of the palace, where he also lived with his wife. Everyone was rumored to be completely happy with this arrangement, and I can only imagine the delighted gossip in the Paris salons of the era. You would think that this palace would have been torn down during the Revolution, but no. Briefly turned into a furniture repository to store seized belongings of departed aristocrats and convicted prisoners, i.e., turning these belongings into part of the national repository for furniture, the palace was returned to the Duchess of Bourbon in 1797. She ran the grounds as a for-profit amusement park open to the public. The next prestigious resident was Joachim Murat, a French statesman who was married to Napoleon Bonaparte's scheming sister Caroline. Known as Venus with the brains of Machiavelli, Caroline fell in love with Murat when she was 15, and she married him despite opposition from her egocentric brother, who wanted to use Caroline as a marriageable pawn. Caroline made this palace into party central for the few years she lived here. When the powerful couple went off to rule Naples, spoiler, that did not go well, the palace was returned to Napoleon, who claimed that staying here was like taking a rest in a sanatorium, far from the crazy fighting of political life. Personally, I think Napoleon brought his own craziness to political life wherever he went, but he was very fashion conscious, so I can imagine that the palace, when he lived here, looked spectacular. After Bonaparte, the palace changed hands repeatedly until 1848, when it began its new and current life as the official residence for the first president of the French Republic. Now, that first president just happened to be Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew, Charles-Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, who was born in Paris in 1808. After a young adulthood spent partly in jail and in exile, at the age of 40, he got himself elected as the first president of France in 1848. With his strong sense of imperial heritage, he soon declared himself Emperor Napoleon III and launched the Second Empire. The glittering 19th century phase, where the City of Light became the modern city of Paris that we know and love. The newly hatched emperor moved his family out of the Élysée and into the Tuileries Palace, but the idea of the Élysée as the presidential home remained. Through the Third, Fourth, and now Fifth Republics, this palace has been the usual home for the French president, Charles de Gaulle, Georges Pompidou, Mitterrand, Chirac, they have all lived here, and they've each changed the decor of their offices according to their personal taste, using the National Furniture Collection, along with its amazing art, tapestries, and rugs. The public rooms of the Élysée range from the gorgeously restored Directoire and Second Empire rooms, with gilded paintings on the wall panels and endless chandeliers, to my favorite weird modern room. You should check my website for photos. You will not believe it. During the presidency of Georges Pompidou, he and his wife, Claude, invited groovy designer Pierre Paulin to create a contemporary sitting room. The year was 1972, so the result feels like a drug-fueled fantasia with a ceiling illumination covered in curving light rods. The furniture in the room is actually made of the same poured aluminum and plastic that was used in the Apollo spaceflight cabin interiors. To be honest, I love this room, but stepping back into the traditional elegant historical rooms does give everyone a bit of whiplash. Up the stairs, hung with impressive gold and crystal chandeliers, there is the main meeting room and the president's office, where I discovered to my great surprise that I really like President Macron's taste in office furniture. His first office is a traditional elegant room with a practical modernist desk, very usable, stacked with papers and books. Very elegant and understated. This is obviously a room where work gets done despite all the chandeliers. There are personal photos, some lovely small sculptures, and there's a working fireplace, which is very practical for the cold, damp winters of Paris. Downstairs, his wife, Madame Brigitte Macron, has her office. I did not like her furniture as much. However, she does have a gorgeous view out into the rose garden, so in summer she probably has the better workplace. The next time you walk along the Champs-Élysées in your imagination or in reality, think of the presidential offices just beyond the gardens. And check out my website, lisapassol.com, for photos and details from my visit. If you've enjoyed this improbable walk, please subscribe to the podcast. Many thanks, as always, to my tiny podcast team, Bremner Fletcher for tech help, and David Simmons for the atmospheric accordion theme music. Thank you also to my Patreons. Take a look for me on the Patreon website under Lisa Passold.